Support for On Point and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. When it comes to the big decision of choosing a mortgage lender, work with one that has your best interests in mind. Use Rocket Mortgage for a transparent, trustworthy home loan process that's completely online at quickenloans.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. America's opioid crisis just keeps roaring, shocking levels of death. Drugs so strong that a dose the size of 2 grains of salt can kill you. We're going to look at the opioid epidemic this hour, but I want to turn first to another story shocking in its way that has riveted Washington and beyond since last night. A U.S. Senator, Senator Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts, silenced on the Senate floor for trying to read a letter from Coretta Scott King, critical of now Alabama Senator Jeff Sessions, President Donald Trump's nominee to be Attorney General of the United States. Joining me from Washington is Matt Visor, Deputy Washington Bureau Chief for the Boston Globe. Matt, welcome back to On Point.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me.
What was happening last night when Senate leadership intervened and silenced Senator Warren?
So Senator Warren took the Senate floor sometime after 8 o'clock, and she was delivering a speech very critical of Jeff Sessions, the senator from Alabama and the attorney general nominee. And she started quoting words, first from Ted Kennedy, who called Jeff Sessions a disgrace to the Justice Department back in 1986 when Sessions was up for a federal judgeship. And he was voted down, actually, in that nomination. Senator Warren was warned at that point about her language. And then she went on to quote from a letter from Coretta Scott King, which was also very critical of Jeff Sessions from the 1980s. And that's when Mitch McConnell sort of took the extraordinary move and came to the Senate floor himself. And they ruled her out of order, that she was violating this arcane Senate rule. 19, and she, the Senate took a vote and upheld that ruling, that she was in violation of that rule, which silences her for the debate over Jeff Sessions and his nomination.
That vote on
quite an extraordinary moment.
Yeah, strict party lines. And, of course, in 1986, now Senator Sessions, who then was not, of course, was denied that federal judgeship because of controversy and concern over racist comments attributed to him, over allegations of voter suppression that he'd been part of. Last night, Senator Warren was reading from the historical record comments from that time, Senator Kennedy and from Coretta Scott King. And here's what began to ensue. You'll hear Mitch McConnell, then just a touch of Senator Warren, then McConnell.
Mr. President.
They are.
Mr. President.
The Majority Leader.
The senator is impugning the motives and conduct of our colleague from Alabama, as warned by the chair. Senator Warren, quote, said Senator Sessions has used the awesome power of his office to chill the free exercise of the vote by black citizens. I call the senator to order under the provisions of Rule 19.
Let's stop right there. Matt Visor of the Boston Globe is with us. So Rule 19, what does it say? He says that she's impugned the motives and conduct of the colleague that would be Jeff Sessions. What's Rule 19, Matt?
So this is an old rule of the Senate that has its roots in 1902, when two senators from South Carolina actually were criticizing each other and got in a fist fight. So the Senate passed a rule where you could not say something impugning the motives of a fellow senator.
But he's up for Attorney General of the United States. This is part of the historical record. They're debating his nomination. Doesn't that make this relevant?
And that's where the criticism is coming, and Democrats have actually pointed also to recent times where Republicans were impugning the motives of Democratic senators, and this rule was not invoked. So they're saying this is sort of selective using of this rule. Other senators remarked, as you say, that Jeff Sessions is up for a very important nomination. Just because he's a senator doesn't mean that they shouldn't be able to look at his record and quote from things and make and articulate the reasons why they're opposing his nomination, which is what Senator Warren was doing.
Here's how that went down last night. Here's the sound of her saying she's surprised that she can't quote the widow of Martin Luther King Jr.
Mr. President, I am surprised that the words of Coretta Scott King are not suitable for debate in the United States Senate. I ask leave of the Senate to continue my remarks.
Is there objection?
Object.
I appeal the ruling.
Objection is heard. The senator will take her seat.
That was Senator Steve Daines of Montana, who was presiding at the time, and Mitch McConnell in the midst of that. What, Matt Visor, what does this mean, that you can only be critical in the committee hearing on a nomination, but not on the Senate floor?
Essentially, yes. And you've seen other senators try to work around this. After Warren was silenced, Ron Wyden from Oregon, a Democrat, got up, and he read portions of the letter as well from Coretta Scott King. So you've seen senators try and work around this and sort of try and get this letter in the record, even though it already actually is in the record from 30 years ago. So it's triggered kind of a barrage of criticism about these arcane Senate rules in a nomination that Republicans have the votes for. You know, I mean, that's what was sort of extraordinary about Mitch McConnell taking this step to try and silence Senator Warren, because they have the votes. And this wouldn't have triggered as much controversy if they just sort of let her read that letter.
I mean, if it was a wild attack of some kind, we might understand. But when it seems entirely germane, though these are Senate rules, but the interpretation is another thing. She stepped out into the hallway outside the Senate chamber and on Facebook Live read the letter. Here's Senator Elizabeth Warren, tossed out, in effect, or silenced in the chamber, outside the chamber, reading the 1986 letter from the 1986 letter of Coretta Scott King. And you'll hear Coretta Scott King's words talking about then Sessions' nomination to be a federal judge. And it's pretty tough language here, saying that in 1986, if he's confirmed, then he'll be given life tenure for doing with a federal prosecution what the local sheriffs accomplished 20 years ago with clubs and cattle prods. Here's Senator Warren reading outside the Senate chamber.
The irony of Mr. Sessions' nomination is that, if confirmed, he will be given life tenure for doing with a federal prosecution what local sheriffs accomplished 20 years ago with clubs and cattle prods. 20 years ago, when we marched from Selma to Montgomery, the fear of voting was real. As the broken bones and bloody heads in Selma and Marion bore witness. As my husband wrote at the time, quote, "It was net just a sick imagination that conjured up the vision of a public official sworn to uphold the law, who forced an inhuman march upon hundreds of Negro children, who ordered the Reverend James Bell to be chained to his sickbed, who clubbed a Negro woman registrant, and who callously inflicted repeated brutalities and indignities upon nonviolent Negroes peacefully petitioning for their constitutional right to vote."
An extraordinary scene there, first recorded on Facebook Live, of a U.S. senator outside the Senate chamber reading from a letter by Coretta Scott King, the widow of Martin Luther King. Coretta Scott King had said that Senator Sessions, she said to put him in charge of the Department of Justice, this is Senator Warren. Coretta Scott King had said that Sessions earlier, when he was, U.S. attorney in West Alabama, had been involved in Coretta Scott King said, a shabby attempt to intimidate and frighten elderly black voters. Here's more of Senator Warren reading from Coretta Scott King's letter outside the Senate chamber.
"It is my strongly held view that the appointment of Jefferson Sessions to the federal bench would irreparably damage the work of my husband, Al Turner, and countless others who risked their lives and freedom over the past 20 years to ensure equal participation in our democratic system. The exercise of the franchise is an essential means by which our citizens ensure that those who are governing will be responsible. My husband called it the number one civil right. The denial of access to the ballot box ultimately results in the denial of other fundamental rights. For it is only when the poor and disadvantaged are empowered that they are able to participate actively in the solutions to their own problems. We still have a long way to go before we can say that minorities no longer need to be concerned about discrimination at the polls. Blacks, Hispanics, Native Americans, and Asian Americans are grossly underrepresented at every level of government in America. If we are going to make our timeless dream of justice through democracy a reality, we must take every step possible to ensure that the spirit and intent of the Voting Rights Act of 1965 and the 15th Amendment of the Constitution is honored.
Senator Elizabeth Warren reading from the letter of Coretta Scott King after she was silenced on the Senate floor. It was Senator Jeff Merkley of Oregon who went ahead and read more of that letter on the floor, but it would not be the Massachusetts senator. Here's just one more bit of her now reading from that 1986 letter from the widow of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., the letter of Coretta Scott King read outside after she'd been silenced on the Senate floor by Senator Warren.
Mr. Sessions has used the awesome power of his office to chill the free exercise of the vote by black citizens in the district he now seeks to serve as a federal judge. This simply cannot be allowed to happen. Mr. Sessions' conduct as a U.S. attorney, from his politically motivated voting fraud prosecutions to his indifference toward criminal violations of civil rights laws, indicates that he lacks the temperament, fairness, and judgment to be a federal judge.
That, Coretta Scott King from 1986. Matt Visor of the Boston Globe is with us. The vote on this is coming in probably tonight. What's likely, Matt?
I mean, it's still likely that Jeff Sessions gets approved, but this has set off sort of a firestorm. Senators right now are going, Democratic senators are going to the floor and also reading from this letter, sort of challenging Mitch McConnell to also silence them. That video of Warren on Facebook has been viewed 6 million times over the past 12 hours. So there's a huge amount of attention now on this. There's a hashtag called Let Liz Speak that has been trending on Twitter. There's fundraising going out, you know, off of this incident. So I think there's a lot more attention on this. There's a lot more attention on the opposition to Jeff Sessions. He will likely be confirmed, but Democrats are also getting a big victory in this in drawing attention to some of the criticism.
Matt Visor with the Boston Globe, we're up against it here, but extraordinary times on the Senate floor. Thank you very much for being with us, Matt.
Thanks for having me.
When we come back, opioids. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. America's opioid crisis keeps shifting and growing. Fentanyl is the latest grim reaper, a synthetic opioid, most out of China, coming straight here or through Canada and Mexico, killing thousands. Ground zero is Ohio. We will go there and beyond. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Will a wall stop this crisis, the opioid crisis? Will it help? Are opioids hitting your community? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or online or at Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Just today, in a speech this morning at the Major Cities Chiefs Association, this is Chiefs of Police, a winter conference in Washington, President Trump told law enforcement officers that he will give them the tools and resources they need to do their jobs, keeping communities safe and to stop drug violence.
So much potential has been sidelined, and so many dreams have been shattered and broken, totally broken. It's time to stop the drugs from pouring into our country. And by the way, we will do that. And I will say this, General, now Secretary Kelly, will be the man to do it, and we will give him a wall, and it will be a real wall, and a lot of things will happen very positively for your cities, your states, believe me.
We'll give him a wall, but will a wall help stop this problem? First guest today is from Toledo, Ohio. Lauren Lindstrom, reporter at the Toledo Blade. She's been writing about the opioid crisis in Ohio. Lauren Lindstrom, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you. Hi, Tom.
Hi. So the latest news I'm hearing, headlines in your newspaper saying Ohio is being called ground zero in the opioid fight. What's going on, Lauren?
Yeah, so that story had to do with a new report that was out of the U.S.-China Economic and Security Review Commission. And what it did is it looked at fentanyl trafficking into the U.S. and really identified China as the number one source of this synthetic, deadly synthetic opioid that's killing a lot of people. The reason that Ohio, we're calling the ground zero here, is because far and away it was the state with the most positive samples of fentanyl for law enforcement tests that were run through this national system. Ohio had just far and away more than any other state. We had nearly 3,900 positive tests from law enforcement samples in 2015. The next state was Massachusetts with about 2,600, and then it just dropped off from there. So Ohio really is seeing, at least from a law enforcement perspective, a lot of fentanyl, and I don't think any law enforcement or health official in Ohio would, be surprised or even, refute that.
Lots in New England, lots in the upper Midwest, lots in Ohio. Ground Zero is your headline. And lots of stories about deaths here. I mean, it seems like every weekend in that region, especially Northeast Ohio, you've got lots of overdose deaths.
Yes, we have a lot. Cleveland has seen a lot. Cincinnati has seen a lot. And they're really pointing it to these synthetic opioids, which are so much stronger than morphine or even heroin. I talked to the special agent who runs the heroin initiative for the Bureau of Criminal Investigation here in Ohio. And, he said anytime you see these mass overdoses where it's 25 in a weekend or, several in a couple hour period, you almost always can point to these synthetics. He said, it's a good bet that when the tox screens come back, it's fentanyl or carfentanil, which we've heard of a lot is the large elephant tranquilizer that had devastating effects down in Cincinnati this summer and this fall and has been up here in Toledo a little bit. So these mass overdoses are just, it's so much stronger, it's so much more potent, and a lot of times users don't know what's in the dosage that they're getting, and they're overdosing way faster than before when it was just heroin, if you can say just heroin.
Yeah, and the strength of these things, just astounding. I mean, we're seeing what fentanyl, 50 or 100 times, something like that, more powerful than heroin. Carfentanil, 100 times stronger than plain fentanyl.
Yeah.
I'm reading here that fentanyl, a dose the size of 2 grains of salt, can kill somebody.
Yeah, and it all depends on kind of how you ingest it. If you inhale it, it can come through touching. That's what's really scary for law enforcement is during investigations, if they're searching scenes after an overdose or a seizure, they have to be really careful with gloves and masks and things like that because it's not just shooting it up or snorting it. That would be dangerous to you, but they worry about, the canine dogs. They worry about the investigators who might come in contact with it, and with almost no quantity, visible or not, you can have a lot of health problems.
Lauren, exactly how is it coming into the country? How's it getting to Ohio? How's it coming into the U.S. from China, if that's the main source?
It's coming from China, and one of the reasons they point to in this report is because there's just very little control on its production and export. Chinese chemical manufacturing is a huge business there. It's got, it's weakly regulated, but has just like the report says, the second largest pharmaceutical market by revenue in the world. And because a lot of there's not a big fentanyl usage problem in China, the government doesn't have a lot of incentive to crack down on it. So it comes in either through Mexico and it's mixed with other heroin or trafficked over the border or sometimes through Canada and then ends up on the streets here in the U.S.
I mean, I was struck by how potent it is. The volume, the actual mass of it can be quite small, and yet the implications quite large for thousands and thousands of people. It's not like you're bringing in some, big, it doesn't have to be trucks full. This could come in small packages and does.
No. Yeah, it comes in, and one of the problems is over the mail. Here in Toledo, we had an instance that law enforcement is always trying to catch up with these, they call them analogs, where the chemical is changed just enough that it's different enough that it doesn't fit under the kind of Schedule 1
prohibited drug rules.
As far as what's an illicit drug, and so they're always catching up with these slightly different variations, and because they are technically not illegal, you can get them through the mail, you can get them through FedEx, and we had a man overdose here in Toledo on something called U47700, which is now called pink colloquially, and Governor Kasich here in Ohio has since banned it and the Board of Pharmacy has, but it was at one point when this man overdosed, he bought it from China online, got it shipped to him and took it and overdosed. And when he was revived, was able to tell law enforcement, hey, this is what I took. But yeah, I mean, there's just a multitude of ways to get it into the country, and law enforcement is kind of scrambling to keep up.
And no small amount apparently coming just in packages, like overnight deliveries or whatever. We heard the president there, President Trump, talking about the wall when he talked to law enforcement today. But we saw John Kelly, the Homeland Security Secretary, when he was in his confirmation hearings, and I'm quoting here, he said it's all about demand. And think about a wall. He said if we were to block the network so nothing could get in through the southwest border, the so-called balloon effect, they'd find other ways around it. The profits are so outrageous. That's why I believe it's all about the demand. What about the wall and the flow of this? I mean, Donald Trump is saying there to General Kelly, you're going to have this wall. But General Kelly in his nomination process saying, well, you know, if you could block the network, it would just come in another way.
Yeah, I mean, certainly we've seen, you know, it doesn't have to just come, you know, directly from shipments, you know, smuggling across the border. They use the mail very successfully. Here in Ohio, our Senator Rob Portman is working on introducing or reintroducing a bill called STOP, which is called the Synthetics Trafficking and Overdose Prevention Act, and it would crack down on or it would increase scrutiny on packages coming internationally overseas and would hopefully better track where those are coming from. So I don't know. I don't think I can speak to exactly how effective the wall would be, but there are definitely efforts in Ohio by our lawmakers to better monitor what's coming across our borders, particularly with this mail and shipment end of things.
Lauren Lindstrom, reporter at the Toledo Blade, writing about the opioid crisis in Ohio. Ground Zero, the headline in the Blade, says, Lauren, thank you very much for being with us from Toledo today.
Thank you.
Of course, it's not just in Ohio. New England has a big problem with this. There's been a big problem in Baltimore and Maryland. Here's a news conference in Annapolis, Maryland, just a week and a half ago. Maryland Republican Governor Larry Hogan announced new legislation to address opioid addiction in Maryland.
It's a crisis that is nearly doubling every single year. And it's getting more and more dangerous, and it's evolving as a crisis. The shift recently has been to fentanyl, and it's 100 times more powerful than heroin, and it's killing people left and right.
That is certainly true. I want to dive on in here on the opioid crisis and what's coming. Dr. Andrew Kolodny joins us. He's co-director of opioid policy research at the Heller School of Social Policy and Management at Brandeis University. Andrew Kolodny, welcome back to One Point. Great to have you here.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
And with us from Baltimore is Dr. Lena Nguyen. She's the health commissioner for Baltimore. Lena Nguyen, Dr. Nguyen, thank you very much. Welcome back to On Point.
And thanks for covering this important issue, Tom.
How is this evolving? I mean, we saw the Oxy stuff a few years ago, and that was all over the place. A lot of it manufactured right here in the country. And then heroin coming in, people sort of put on the path toward heroin, we told, by OxyContin use. And now fentanyl. What's the evolution you see? Where are we, Dr. Nguyen, Lena Nguyen, at this point in the opioid crisis?
We are at a point of a public health emergency. We know that this is an issue in Ohio, in Baltimore, and all across the country. Here in Baltimore, the number of people dying from fentanyl overdose has increased by 20 times in the last 3 years. It's a multifaceted problem. We do have a culture here where we treat every pain with a pill. We know that there is an overprescribing of opioid painkillers that happens. But we also know that fentanyl, this new deadly drug, is now being mixed in with heroin, even with cocaine, with other drugs, and it is killing people in droves. But to the last conversation, enforcement is one part of the solution because we do have to reduce supply. But there's another part that's extremely important too, which is also that we have to reduce demand. There is a huge treatment gap that exists for treating the disease of addiction. A recent Surgeon General report found that only 1 in 10 people who have the disease of addiction, and science is unequivocal that addiction is a disease, only 1 in 10 people with addiction are getting the help that they need. I'm an ER doctor, and I've seen patients who are seeking treatment for addiction who are told that they have to wait weeks or even months to get that help. It doesn't work to incarcerate individuals. It actually further stigmatizes them. We would never consider incarcerating somebody who has the disease of diabetes. And this situation is not going to get better unless we can get people treatment at the time that they need, or else they're going to continue using drugs and continue to overdose and die.
Dr. Claudine, Andrew Claudine with me here in the studio. What's the significance of fentanyl coming into this equation? I mean, we're looking at heroin, 4 to 5 times the potency of morphine, I read here. Fentanyl, about 100 times the potency of morphine. When you get something so potent, does it change? Or is it the same dynamic as when it was OxyContin or when it was, you know, brown heroin coming in? Is it a different deal when it's so potent?
What we're seeing since 2011 with the heroin supply increasingly having fentanyl in it, and in some cases fentanyl being sold as heroin, what we're seeing is a skyrocketing in overdose deaths among heroin users. But it's really important to understand that the opioid addiction epidemic is affecting roughly two populations. Mm-hmm. There's an older group that's mostly developing their opioid addiction through pain treatment and is dying of overdoses on prescription opioids. And we are still seeing more overdose deaths from prescription opioids than from heroin and fentanyl. And there's a younger group that's developing opioid addiction, I'd say, more often from non-medical or recreational use, sometimes from medical use. Mm-hmm. That young group, when they become addicted, they have a difficult time maintaining their opioid supply visiting doctors. Doctors don't like giving healthy-looking 25-year-olds a large quantity of pills on a monthly basis. So that young group has been winding up on the black market from the beginning of the prescription opioid crisis. Beginning in the 1990s, we started to see increasing use of heroin among young whites who were getting opioid addicted. Mm-hmm. But we still actually see more overdose deaths in the older group that receives painkillers more easily from doctors than we're seeing in the younger group that's turning to this very dangerous heroin.
What about the fentanyl, Dr. Nguyen? Is it actually prescribed for pain legitimately? For we're reading about cancer patients here, and does that sort of pharmaceutical fentanyl make its way into the illicit market, or is it mainly mixed in with heroin?
There are legitimate uses of fentanyl, just as there is for many types of opioids, of opioid painkillers. In the ER, I prescribed patients fentanyl who are screaming in pain after a car accident. They have a broken hip. Patients with chronic cancer pain, as you mentioned. There are legitimate uses. What we're seeing in Baltimore and what we understand around the country is that fentanyl is being manufactured in labs in other countries.
China, number one, we're just told. Mm-hmm.
That's right, and being trafficked in through mail and through other things. And unfortunately, individuals using fentanyl aren't aware that they're using it. So they think that they're using their usual amount of heroin. But now that there's fentanyl, this extremely powerful drug mixed in there, and they're overdosing and they're dying.
But where is that happening? Is that happening in Mexico where the fentanyl comes in and they're like, I don't know, people sort of stirring it into the heroin? Or presumably it's not heroin being sent in by overnight delivery. That would just be straight fentanyl. What's the mix, Dr. Nguyen?
Fentanyl is sometimes used to cut heroin. It is cheaper than heroin, as we understand. And so there is a difference I want to separate, too, between the individuals who are trafficking in fentanyl, these high-level dealers, if you will. And there are lots of people on the ground who are low-level or what we call subsistence dealers, which means that they are selling drugs only in order to feed their own habit. These individuals are selling fentanyl mixed in with heroin, but they themselves often don't know it. And that's my concern, that if we try to criminalize this even more, then we are further adding to the stigma. We're further preventing individuals from seeking treatment. And really what we need to do is to increase access to treatment, because otherwise people are not going to get better. And we're going to continue treating addiction as a moral failing and a crime, which is unscientific, inhumane, and ineffective.
Andrew Kalani, what are the prospects for treatment? We're seeing health care debates in this country right now. The Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, may go away. Would that change the treatment profile in the country?
Difficult to say. We have very poor access to a medicine called buprenorphine, which I would say is the first-line treatment.
Give us that name again. What is it?
Buprenorphine.
Buprenorphine.
One of the brand names is Suboxone. And long-term treatment with that medication is one of our best options for people who are opioid addicted. Unfortunately, there are many federal regulations linked to that drug and very limited prescribing by primary care doctors. So if we're going to do a better job of treatment, we have to have much better access to that medicine.
Support for On Point and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. When it comes to the big decision of choosing a mortgage lender, work with one that has your best interests in mind. Rocket Mortgage provides a transparent online process that helps you understand all the details of your home loan. You can even adjust the rate and length of your loan in real time to make sure you get the right mortgage solution for you. Skip the bank, skip the waiting, and go completely online at quickenloans.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSConsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about America's opioid crisis still growing and what comes next. You can join us. Have you seen the arc here from OxyContin to heroin to, God forbid, fentanyl and worse, or all three or four or more? What do we need to treat this? What do we need to stop this? Will a border wall stop this when it's coming in by overnight delivery in U.S. mail? Of course, there's a new administration in town in Washington. President Trump, in a speech this morning at the Major Cities Chiefs Association, Police Chiefs, conference in Washington, D.C., talking with top law enforcement officials about the drugs coming into the country.
We're going to stop those drugs from poisoning our youth, from poisoning our people. We're going to be ruthless in that fight. We have no choice. And we're going to take that fight to the drug cartels and work to liberate our communities from their terrible grip of violence.
Okay, sounds good. But how exactly? And what about treatment? Dr. Andrew Kolodny is with us from Brandeis University, the Heller School for Social Policy and Management there. Dr. Lena Nguyen is with us. She is health commissioner in Baltimore, trained emergency physician herself. And Dr. Nguyen, Dr. Kolodny, lots of callers for the two of you. Christian in Lexington, Kentucky. Christian, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Yeah, I've got a lot of experience. I live next door to a home where a hillbilly heroin dealer and a heroin dealer have been arrested multiple times and spent decades in prison are in and out. The police here are overwhelmed. I've asked them, you know, when are you going to call in the National Guard? This is a problem that is in every community. Starter homes, I live in an established, very nice community where, you know, a fixer-upper is $600,000. Most homes on my street have swimming pools and are well over $1 million.
What's hillbilly heroin, Christian? Define it for our listeners.
Okay, hillbilly heroin is OxyContin that's sold by I don't want to call him a fake doctor, but he's a doctor, and there's one very famous in Kentucky, in Harlan, Kentucky. You can look him up. He's in and out of the home next door to me.
What do you need to stop it? What do you think would stop it or tamp it down?
Well, it's not Narcan, so the Lexington Safety Commissioner gets $25,000 grants for Narcan, which will take opioid or heroin abusers out of an overdose.
Yeah.
But they don't want that. They basically want the high. So I'm a Jill Stein Green Party member, so I'm watching this with some degree of emotional and intellectual detachment. But I can tell you here in Ground Zero that it's turning into a push button issue, just like abortion.
What do you mean push button issue? What's the controversy?
Well, Trump can push my button on this and turn me into a Trump voter if he can solve this issue, if he can solve this problem.
Ah, yeah. Okay, solve this problem. And Christian, who's got it, he says right next door, will be happier. Christian, let us hang on to that one and go to, if I may, Ohio, Dayton, Ohio. Ohio's being called Ground Zero here, though it's not only there, right here and across the country. Ryan in Dayton, thank you for calling.
Hi. Yes, the wall will not help. What we're finding is that people are flying in. Drug mules are flying in, and they are swallowing the carfentanil. They are swallowing it in pill format. They're going to the local hotels. They're getting that out of their system, digging through that, and then it is going and hitting the street. We have programs in Dayton, Ohio, that are helpful with front door programs, people who are not going to be arrested for their drug use, but they can go and receive treatment at any time of the day and get into the system to receive treatment. However, they're choosing not to stay, and we're losing them there. But we have success stories from that happening, from people going in and being able to speak with someone immediately.
Ryan, I appreciate your call. I mean, that sounds rough to stop. They're flying in with carfentanil. I mean, that's the worst. That's the strongest. Flying in from where, Ryan?
Well, you know, they're flying all over.
Yeah.
But our local, the smaller airports, carfentanil, fentanyl, heroin, they're flying into the smaller airports. Your Dayton airports, your Indianapolis, and that's when we see more problems.
I appreciate your call, Ryan. Lena Nguyen in Baltimore, if you could ask, I don't know, one, two, three things from the new Trump administration to help you at the Baltimore level, the city level, what would they be?
So I agree with Ryan that a wall will not help. We actually know what helps. But I want to say one thing to President Trump, which is that there was a recent study looking at the areas of the highest concentration of drug overdoses. And those areas entirely coincided with the areas that voted predominantly for President Trump.
This is a Penn State report. I saw that. I saw they voted very high for Donald Trump. And we're talking about industrial Midwest, New England, Appalachia, with the places with the highest mortality rates from drugs, alcohol, suicide. And there was the vote.
That's right. And these are the same areas that face uncertain futures, unemployment, unstable housing, and really are suffering from these diseases of despair where people are treating something other than just physical pain. When tomorrow is no better than today, what we need to address, if President Trump really wants to address the disease of addiction, he needs to look at the evidence and what works. We know that treatment exists. We know that recovery is possible. We know that there are millions of people around the country who are in long-term recovery. What we know is that we need more resources in order to get there. If the president said that we need to devote our attention to cancer or Alzheimer's, the immediate next question is going to be, how much are we going to be devoting to solving this crisis, to solving this public health emergency? We now need to devote that same level of resources in order to address the demand for these drugs. Addressing supply through a wall is not enough. And we critically also have to focus on saving lives. Now, to when Christian talked about Narcan or Naloxone, that's the antidote medication to reverse an opioid overdose.
Yeah.
In the ER, I've used this hundreds of times. And here in Baltimore City, we have trained everyday people, lay people. We've done over 20,000 trainings in the last 2 years. And 800 individuals have had their lives saved by neighbors saving neighbors. We need to save a life tomorrow to ensure, or we need to save a life today to ensure a better tomorrow.
Dr. Kolodny, what would you say? President Trump, here's one, two, three things that would be most important.
Yeah, I think much of what Dr. Nguyen said is right on target. But to really bring our opioid crisis under control, you first have to understand it. And our opioid crisis is really an epidemic of opioid addiction. And we don't have an epidemic of opioid addiction because heroin and fentanyl are flooding in. Heroin and fentanyl are flooding in because we have so many people who are addicted and there's been this increase in demand.
Yeah, but wait, I mean, those go both ways, right? I mean, people got hooked on this in the first place because there were so many painkillers out there.
Correct. So there is a complex relationship between supply and demand. And you're exactly right. The reason we do have so many Americans who are opioid addicted is because we overexposed the population to prescription opioids. Doctors began to increase their prescribing and it led to this crisis, which is why one of the most important things we have to do is promote more cautious prescribing. If we want the epidemic to ultimately end, we have to stop creating new cases of opioid addiction, and that boils down to more cautious prescribing.
We're going to go in just a moment to Lenny Bernstein at the Washington Post to look at what may be coming from the Trump administration on this front. But so many callers. Mike in Sarasota, Florida. Mike, you're on the air. Micah.
Hi there, Tom. Just wanted to talk about how 20-year-olds are getting fentanyl these days because it's not through dealers like you guys are talking about. I'm a college student in Sarasota, and two of my friends actually have already died overdosed on fentanyl.
Wow.
And, today kids don't need to go to a dealer. You don't got to go to some sketchy house to get the fentanyl. You can just go on the internet. And any 14, it's not hard to do. Anyone can do it. You can go on the deep web and get a catalog of cocaine, heroin, I mean, anything. You name it. And, you know, a 15-year-old has access to these drugs. They can ship it to their house like it's nothing.
Where does it come in from, Micah? Is it shipped from within the United States or from abroad? Do you know?
Anywhere, both. I mean, it's the internet. You can connect to the Netherlands. You can connect to China. I mean, it's a huge network that people are unaware of that, you know, 13-year-olds are tapping into. And it's really totally unregulated. And, you know, I think the conversation has to move away from these, like, stereotypical, you know, scary dealers that people are going to.
Yep.
It's not that way anymore. People are staying at home and never interacting with anyone like that. You can just, you know, click a few buttons and get a drug that you don't even know if it's that drug, and you'll get it in your mailbox in a week.
Boy, talk about hard to stop. Mike, I really appreciate your call from Sarasota. I want to go to Washington and Lenny Bernstein, health and medicine reporter at the Washington Post. Lenny, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
We've heard a lot about the wall from the Trump administration. Donald Trump talked on the campaign trail about trying to stop some of this sort of mail order delivery of these drugs. We've got a new Health and Human Services Secretary coming in at some point. What about policy? What do we know? What's coming, Lenny? Will it be different from Obama-era policy?
Well, they haven't been very specific about anything other than the wall. In the speech on the campaign trail, as you mentioned, and in the speech to the law enforcement officers the other day, it was all about the wall. There was a little bit of discussion of strengthening partnerships with law enforcement agencies along the border, but it's been very vague. It's been very nonspecific at the moment. And, you know, we're only 3 weeks into the new administration. What we're hearing right now about is the wall and how the wall is going to keep drugs from coming in from Mexico. All the people who just spoke before me, the two doctors that you have on,
yes,
and the callers have made it very clear why that's not going to work. Dr. Price has not been mentioned, asked about this at all, as far as I could tell.
Tom Price, the nominee.
Yes, the nominee to head up HHS. The senators have been mostly asking him about drug prices, the prices of legal pharmaceuticals, but nothing about opioids that I can find.
And what about treatment for this? Both Dr. Kolodny and Dr. Nguyen in Baltimore there say, you know, that's number one, maybe. The Affordable Care Act, I assume, has extended treatment to some people. If that goes away, what happens on the treatment front?
It's really hard to tell. There's nothing that we know there's nothing that we know now that tells us what the replacement for the Affordable Care Act is going to be. I will mention that Congress last year passed the Comprehensive Addiction Recovery Act. That calls for more treatment, more education, more prevention. So there is that, and that's a good thing. I imagine Dr. Kolodny and Dr. Nguyen see that as bringing some money to their communities for recovery and treatment, but we don't know what's coming behind the Affordable Care Act once it's repealed. The other thing to remember is it's getting clearer to the Republican majority in Congress how difficult it is to repeal the Affordable Care Act and what they might replace it with, and they have become more hesitant. They are talking about delays. The president himself has said it may not happen until 2018, so we just have to wait and see at the moment.
Sam in Omaha, Nebraska. Sam, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. Yeah, I am a recovering heroin addict. My story's pretty typical. You know, I've been using opioids for about 6 or 7 years, tried many different methods of treatment, and I have to say what's worked best for me, I've tried Suboxone, which did not work, but I've now been in a methadone treatment program for about just over 3 years. I've had a couple of brief relapses, but by and large, it's been successful. I know it's an old treatment. I know it's been under a lot of scrutiny. And
we're glad you're on it, though, Sam. I'm going to stick with it, man. But what will stop this, Sam? What do we need to do?
Well, it's what people have been talking about before. There needs to be action at the community level, the state level, and the federal level. There needs to be more funding for treatment programs like this. The program I go to is very inexpensive. It's only $60 a month. And if you're indigent or homeless, it's essentially free. We need to keep introducing more things like that. Suboxone didn't work for me, but it can work for millions of others, you know. And there's a treatment method that they have in Europe called heroin-assisted treatment. And it sounds completely counterintuitive, but I believe that if it were brought to the United States, it would be very effective and very helpful. And essentially, people go there and they use heroin every day in places like Switzerland or Germany, I think. And they maybe get a dose of methadone to take home at night. And the recidivism rates are extremely low. and it's very effective. And
Sam, I want to get into cost here, and I appreciate your call from Omaha, and stay straight, man. We wish you all the best with that. Lena Nguyen, Sam's talking about $60 a month for treatment, but we're hearing about prices that are now being charged for Narcan and more that are way above that. What about the pricing structure about treatments for overdose and more?
It's a huge problem, and it's one reason why I'm so concerned about any repeal of the Affordable Care Act. We know that there is this huge treatment gap that exists if only 1 in 10 people can get the treatment that they need. The ACA has allowed millions of Americans to get access to care for the first time, and we have had expansion of mental health care, of substance use disorder treatment for many of these individuals. And there is no safety margin for individuals who have the disease of addiction. If someone loses coverage and they now cannot get their medications, they now can't get their counseling, their only respite is going to be going out onto the streets and using illegal drugs and potentially overdosing. Now, there have been, and Lenny mentioned, the CARA Act, a number of Republicans through a bipartisan effort have supported the concept that addiction is a disease that we have to treat it. But that rhetoric is not enough. We need resources because we know that there are treatments that work, like methadone and buprenorphine, combined with counseling, combined with other services like housing, which is also healthcare.
Does it come down to jobs and hope? I mean, beneath all this, is that part of what's going on here? I mean, what an irony that so much of this fentanyl is coming from China. Of course, you know, Western powers pushed opium into China a couple of centuries ago, and now here it comes. Your family came from China, Dr. Nguyen, I know. What an irony that's coming from China now. How do you stop the demand? Is it about treatment or is it about some kind of social or economic change?
It's about both. It's about both. This is not an easy problem with one solution. This is something that we have to address in many ways. But for me as a doctor, seeing my patients who are asking for help, knowing that these individuals need help and I can't get them that help that they need, or seeing that they're priced out of it because they don't have something as basic as health insurance, it's just unconscionable. And that's something that we have to change today.
It's no joke. We're hearing today a wall alone won't do it. The president's own head of the Homeland Security Department saying the same thing, General John Kelly. Lots of pieces to this, and it is urgent. The death rate is astounding sometimes. Dr. Lena Nguyen, Health Commissioner for the City of Baltimore, thank you very much for being with us, Dr. Nguyen.
Thank you.
Dr. Andrew Kolodny at the Heller School at Brandeis University, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
And Lenny Bernstein of the Washington Post, stay in touch. We want to see how this policy develops. Thank you very much for being with us today, Lenny.
My pleasure.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Thank you.